Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie, as always, joined by John. What is up?
Not much, man. Living the life over here. How are you?
Are you? I'm living a cold life is what I'm doing.
It is like sickeningly cold outside. I don't even know if that's a word. That's how cold it is. I'm making up words.
I love the cold and I'm cold. So
I love the cold when it's like summertime and it's 70 and people think that's cold. That's the kind of cold I like.
So you like fake cold?
Yeah. I feel like you've given me a real cold. Like you, you've been like under
are
the weather.
Sick?
I think I can feel it coming, like a bad storm, you know?
I think you just, I don't know. There's a word for people who catch all the illnesses and I can't think of it, but you have that.
You're going to catch these hands. You keep talking to me like that.
Golly. All right. Well, we got a good case today that is not John beating me up, I hope.
We do. Before, well, I mean, I'm going to beat you up, but we'll do the case first. No, I want to say thank you to Suds Media. And Suds Media joined our Patreon. So I need to look up Suds Media and see what they're all about. Maybe we can do some kind of partnership or something.
Sounds sudsy.
Yeah, Suds Media. So thank you, Suds Media. And yeah, we've had a good run over on Patreon. Don't forget, for the month of January, we are offering a 10% off an annual or a monthly membership. So take advantage of that.
Awesome Blossom. A little extra awesome there.
Dude, an Awesome Blossom sounds great.
It does. Yeah, today's case, I'm going to be honest, is pretty heavy for a number of reasons. I do realize that there was an incident on New Year's Day where a former military veteran blew up a Tesla. And we wrote this before that, but I think this may lend itself to that conversation just a bit. But we'll see when we get there, John. So why don't you get us rolling?
In the pre-dawn hours of March 11th, 2002, a chilling silence came upon two small villages in a district of Kandahar, which is in Afghanistan. And that silence, however, was shattered by the sound of gunfire, screams, and the terrifying crackle of flames.
Staff Sergeant Robert Bales, who was a decorated American soldier, had left his base, and he embarked on a killing spree that left 16 innocent Afghan civilians, including women and children, dead. And these events obviously were part of just a ton of violence happening over there at the time, and I know we often hear about the stories that happened during combat, but this was a non-combat incident, and it created a lot of controversy back home in the United States.
Yeah, so today we're going to delve deep into the details of the Kandahar massacre. We're going to explore the events that led to this tragic incident, the devastating impact on the victims and their families, and the complex legal battle and international repercussions of Robert Bales' actions. We'll examine the psychological toll of the war, the complexities and the international relations, and the enduring questions that linger in the wake of this horrific crime.
Yeah. Before we get into this and it gets super serious, I have a confession to make about Kandahar.
Okay.
I've never made a Kandahar confession before. Have you ever heard of the Kandahar Giant?
The Kandahar Giant? No.
Okay. I've been in this weird rabbit hole on podcast listening and TikTok lately about giants existing, and there were reports of a giant being found by American soldiers in Kandahar. There are some say that they're the ones that they killed it. Some others say they flew it out. Just throwing all that out there to get it out of my head, because that's where it's been living pretty tight.
This case is around the same time that two of my best friends were both in Afghanistan and Iraq. They're twin brothers. I reference them all the time because one of them worked at the Colorado Supermax prison he returned back from Afghanistan. They did a couple of tours of duty. I'm gonna ask them about if they knew of this Robert Bales guy. And then I'm also going to throw in the Kandahar Giant because I'm super interested to talk to them about that.
Let's ask him about the giant. All right. Some background here on Robert Bales. He was a native of Lake Taps, Washington. He grew up in a middle-class family, by all intents and purposes, had a fairly normal childhood. Straight out of high school, he enlisted in the Army, and he said he felt a sense of duty and a desire to serve his country. He quickly distinguished himself as a dedicated soldier, one of the top in his class. He excelled in his training. He had a strong work ethic, and it seemed like the military was a great fit for Robert.
He served multiple tours in Iraq. He witnessed some of the horrifying war that happened there firsthand. He experienced the same as any other soldier there, the constant threat of death. Talking to my friends that came home, they said that they were trained to be in a state of constant suspicious alertness, which basically means you're on edge for the fear of your life 24/7.
Which sounds like paranoia, but that's the mode you have to stay in to stay alive and to keep your fellow soldiers alive.
And based on my personal experiences with them, once you turn that on in your brain, it's not a switch that you can easily turn off. It comes back with you. He also saw the trauma of witnessing violence and human suffering and the intense pressure of operating in a hostile environment. These experiences, coupled with the physical demands of combat, took a significant toll on his mental and emotional well-being. I want to go ahead and say that if you're already playing with a shorthand and you experience all this, those equal a lethal cocktail.
Can you talk about what you mean by playing with a shorthand?
Yeah, if you already have mental health issues and then you experience all of these things that would leave like the most normal human being imaginable traumatized and changed, then I call it playing with a shorthand, meaning that you don't have the good cards in your hand. You're playing with a bad hand of cards, and then you take on more cards that are also really, really bad.
Yeah, and I knew what you meant. I just wanted you to go into it for our listeners a little bit, because I think over the course of time, we've come to a place of it's not nature versus nurture. It's nature and nurture versus you, essentially. It's a combination of the two, and I think that's what we see here. And the well-being of soldiers is something that we're going to come back to a lot throughout these conversations. You mentioned getting more bad cards. He continued to get that. He got multiple concussions during his deployment. Injuries that can have long-term neurological and psychological consequences. We know now, especially with athletes, that there is real long-term damage done to your brain when you get these concussions.
Well, and he suffered some traumatic brain injuries as a football player before he even went to Afghanistan. So that's kind of what I meant by playing with a shorthand, is he already had experienced trauma and like physical injuries. And then he went and experienced even more horrific things.
Obviously, we talk about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder in veterans. I mean, the constant paranoia. And I think that just the way you have to live your life makes it so difficult to mentally adjust back to civilian life. And all veterans have to go through a struggle to do that. But for some, it's really extreme.
I think it's important to understand that PTSD can manifest in a variety of ways. Some of those include nightmares, flashbacks, hypervigilance, difficulty in concentrating, emotional outbursts, and feelings of detachment. TBI, often caused by exposure to blasts of the heads or other traumatic events, can also have a significant neurological and psychological consequence, and those can include cognitive impairment, emotional dysregulation, and behavioral issues. Jamie, and I think that it's important to say that not everyone with PTSD or TBI is going to be explosively angry, but they will have some lingering effects of PTSD or the TBI.
And TBI stands for traumatic brain injury.
Sorry to keep referencing my friends, but man, I lived with them right after they came back from, I think, their second tour of duty. And I would, like, if I came in late at night, I almost treated them as if they were my parents. Mm-hmm. Not because they needed to know when I was coming home, but I needed them to know that it was me coming home at 1 o'clock in the morning and not an intruder. Otherwise, I could have been met with some violence.
Right. Yeah.
Not that they were violent guys, but they were semi-awake waiting on something bad to happen, and then they hear a strange noise outside. I just wanted to give them the peace of mind knowing that it's me.
And while I do think, or maybe hope's the right word, that military culture is getting better, it's really hard to balance the mentality you have to have with your mental health. The emphasis is on strength, resilience, getting the job done no matter what. So if you come forward and say, I'm really struggling with something, it's hard to do that. And just the culture itself discourages soldiers from seeking help. Again, I hope that's changing very much. It prevents soldiers from accessing necessary support, treatment, which obviously just makes the mental health challenges even more risky and creates more negative outcomes, which is what you're trying to avoid in the first place. That's why we see a lot of veterans come back and there's substance abuse, violence issues, even self-harm. And a lot of that comes back to a lack of mental wealth, as we talked about, I think, with our with Magic Mind last week, like mental health care for these veterans.
And we'll talk more about his opportunities to confront some of those issues and then his willingness to do so later. But like many other veterans, he was struggling with the invisible wounds of war in the months leading up to what we're about to talk about, this massacre. He was experiencing some high levels of stress and anxiety. And I mean, I think it's probably safe to say that everyone else in his company were probably experiencing similar things. But for some reason, he would go on to do some pretty awful things. He reportedly struggled with sleep deprivation, which was likely from the demanding operational tempo and the constant stress of combat.
Yeah, and there are reports that he was also consuming large amounts of alcohol, potentially anabolic steroids during this time. We talked about it in another recent case. Those are substances that create almost opposite reactions in your body. So it really takes a toll psychologically, mentally, and physically. And we're going to take a break. We've set the stage here. We're going to take a quick break and come back, and we're going to dive straight into what actually happened with Robert Bales on that night of March 11th.
We've been building up to it, but now let's get into March 11th. So in the middle of the night.
This was in 2012, by the way. I didn't note that in the script.
March 11th, 2012, under the cover of darkness, Bales would leave his base, and he walked to two villages that were nearby, and he systematically would enter homes. He would kill everyone in the home, men, women, and children. The violence was brutal, and it didn't matter how old you were, your age, you were a victim, and you were going to suffer from his gunshot wounds. He would also stab people and burn people. This was awful. This was not something that was sanctioned by the military. This was Robert on a personal mission.
And again, he was sneaking out of his base. This wasn't that they were out on a particular job or mission that day, and he just happened to swing into a house. This was him leaving his base to go out and commit these acts of violence. In some cases, he ended up setting the bodies of his victims on fire. He left a huge trail of destruction. Often the attacks lasted for several hours, including torture before they were killed. And these villages that were suffering this fate, they were fairly defenseless. Like, he was a well-trained, really strong military soldier, and if he came into your house, there was not a lot that you could do.
So the news of this massacre sent shockwaves throughout not only Afghanistan, of course, but also through the United States. The Afghan president condemned the attacks and said that this was unforgivable and inhumane, while the U.S. government expressed deep regret and offered condolences to the grieving families of Afghanistan. This was not something that America as a whole wanted to see happen. I mean, they were there for a mission, but this was not part of it.
And a lot of people, of course, this was in, theoretically, in response to 9/11, war on terrorism. I think as far as wars go, the beginning of this one, America was on the same page more than maybe most wars, but you know, that it took a long time to get out of there. So
I mean, my entire adult life up until just a few years ago, we were in this war.
Yeah.
2011 happened when I was 17 years old. And up until just a few years ago, we were still in that war.
Yeah.
But I think during, and I could be wrong, I'm not a American history expert, but in 2012, I feel like that's probably when we were working with Afghanistan to help them train their own soldiers to help combat terrorism for themselves.
Yeah. And you know, I hope that was the case, but I think this is over a decade after 9/11. I think by this time people are starting to turn their focus and say, you know what, we need to get out of there. There's too much violence happening. So back in the United States, when they got word of these attacks, there was outrage in the public. A lot of people questioning, why are we still over there anyway? Why aren't we taking care of our soldiers? This incident reignited the debate over what we were actually doing there and the ethical implications of our intervention after Osama bin Laden was killed and that kind of thing.
Well, as you can imagine, this also strained the political relationship between the United States and Afghan. And yeah, it definitely complicated the already fragile security situation that was happening in the country. The Afghanistan government demanded swift justice for the victims and increased accountability for the American armed forces that were there in their country.
And what's interesting about things like this, John, is that we get these reports mostly from our government. Like, the government interactions is what we want to hear. We do have some great journalists who get to the bottom of these stories, but especially international affairs is really hard for us to get the truth, I think. From either side, we really get a tainted view of what's happening over there. Once this was discovered, Bales was apprehended by fellow soldiers, American soldiers, shortly after one of his attacks, and he was subsequently charged with 17 counts of murder, 6 counts of attempted murder, and 6 counts of assault. These charges carried the possibility of the death penalty, which again raised even more ethical and legal questions about how that could be carried out.
Of course, you can imagine this case garnered a lot of intense media attention, with every detail of the investigation scrutinized by public. Legal experts debated the merits of the charges, the potential defenses that could be, you know, what potential defense would there be, and the appropriate punishment that would be given to Bales for committing such a awful, heinous, and dramatic crime.
Now, military justice system operates within a very distinct, specific framework. It's not like there's a, even in America, every state does things somewhat differently in the court system and the way charges are laid out, and federal court also exists in every state. It's pretty complex, but the military has their own system where they try to uphold the rights of their soldiers while carrying out military discipline. Now, this creates challenges in maybe the most famous movie with a military court is A Few Good Men. You Can't Handle the Truth.
You Can't Handle the Truth.
Pretty awesome movie, but it kind of toes the line of, we're governing ourselves. Where's the line in doing this the right way and doing this the way that looks best in the public?
Yeah, and they had to, the military justice system had to grapple with that. This was a complex case, and it was prosecuting one of your own for awful crimes committed in a foreign war zone. So, of course, questions would arise about the role of mental health in criminal responsibility. Could Robert Bales' actions be contributed to undiagnosed or untreated mental health conditions such as PTSD or TBI?
The defense team argued that this was all a result of Bales' mental state, exacerbated by factors such as his sleep deprivation, his alcohol consumption, the stresses of being in a war zone and being in combat, and that everything going on in Bales' life really culminated in essentially him losing touch and committing these actions. So there, I mean, I don't think they use the word insanity defense, but they're saying his mental state is what caused this and he couldn't help it.
Right. And the prosecution would argue, and I guess who's the prosecution? Is it also the government?
Yeah, it's all military prosecutors.
You've got military prosecutors, military defendants. The prosecution would argue that Bales was definitely fully aware of his actions and that his crimes were not only deliberate, but premeditated.
Now, we also see this outside of the military, of course. We see a lot of conversations about whether crimes are committed under the, I guess, the knowing intention of somebody who is mentally of capacity to commit such crimes. So this is not unique to the military, but it played a major role in this case. It's pretty much all that it hinged on. But by the time that he actually got to trial, Bales ended up pleading guilty to all charges. This was in June of 2013, and he did this, most people think, just to avoid the death penalty. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole for his actions in Kandahar.
So this case raised important questions about international law and, of course, accountability. So you ever heard of the Geneva Convention?
Yes, I have.
This is not like a group of old ladies who get together.
That's it certainly
whenever I would hear like that on the news, I'm like, oh, Geneva. She sounds like a great-grandmother.
It's lovely this kind of year.
The Geneva Convention is a series of international agreements that set out the standards of international humanitarian law for the treatment of civilians, prisoners of war, and wounded in war. Explicitly prohibit the targeting of civilians. So this is basically like all the major powers of Earth got together and said, these are things that we can all agree on that are not okay during times of war. Please follow them. Signed, earthly leaders.
Yeah, so I mean, there are sanctions in place if you violate these, but who's going to enforce them? There is no global government. There is the United Nations, but in some other groups, but there's no global government. So the fact that I admire that they wanted to put something in place here to prevent inhumane treatment of people, but also you're killing a lot of people at war. And I don't, like, it's a, you're saying, okay, it's all right, we're going to kill millions of people from each country, but if we capture one, we're not going to do this, this, and this to them.
Right, and the Geneva Convention really emphasizes the importance of distinguishing between members of the combat, like combatants, and civilians. So what you do to, if you were to capture a combatant, that's totally different than how you would handle capturing a civilian. It's never okay to capture a civilian. They live in the country that you're at war with, but they have nothing to do with what's going on. However, if one of those happens to be a soldier of that country, then they're treated differently. Does that make sense?
It does, but I just find it intriguing because this is all in the middle of a war where we're killing as many people as we can sometimes.
Yeah.
And, or as many people in a certain area that we need to send whatever message.
War happens where people live. I think we've been, I shouldn't say that. Like, I was going to say we've been spoiled that we've never had to live through war in our country, but in a way we did. I mean, we were not in New York City or the other, like Washington, D.C., or was it Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where the other plane crashed. We weren't in those areas, but we lived during that time, and we saw on television the hitting of the second tower. We experienced that on our soil, but I'm talking about the long-term kind of war, like where soldiers are marching down your streets, going into homes, looking for bad guys, that kind of war. We've never personally been through that, but for Afghanistan, that's what was going on. We were there, we were in their country, and there happened to be civilians living amongst, you know, in a war zone. So this Geneva Convention, it really just holds the world, I guess, who's bought into this, kind of accountable for what we do while we're there.
Yeah, and it does prohibit prisoners of war, torture of certain kinds, which, of course, there are stories from Guantanamo Bay after 9/11 of things we did that potentially violated that, but who's going to tell on you? It's such an odd set of circumstances to try to govern in any way. It obviously prohibits the destruction of civilian property as well as murder directly of civilians. Enforcing these laws gets really complex, though, when you start looking at the places where it happens. Is it international law? Is the Army or that military branch going to handle it? Are we going to bring them back to the United States or do it overseas? Just so many complexities that go into an American citizen carrying out a war crime as an individual, not on behalf of the military.
Let's play devil's advocate. I mean, if we didn't have the international law, the Geneva Convention, I mean, the Afghanistan government could have arrested him and treated him as an Afghani and held him in their courts, right?
I guess, but also...
Like, if I just went to Afghanistan on my own and not government-sanctioned and I killed somebody, I'm under their law.
Yeah.
So, I guess it's different for him because he was there on government business but committed a non-government-sanctioned crime. It's interesting, but, you know, part of me thinks maybe the Afghans should have had more of a say in what happened to him. I don't think he'd be alive today.
Yeah, I think you're right. It just comes to jurisdiction, and international law makes everything so tricky. I mean, we have agreements with other countries, but there are some countries that won't do extradition. I mean, we have whistleblowers and such living in other countries. There are some countries that will say, yeah, if we got one of your criminals, we'll arrest them and bring them to you. But some countries are like, nah, we'll just keep them. It's such an odd, international law is just fascinating to me.
I was watching a movie this weekend with my son. This is a little rabbit hole, but I was watching Catch Me If You Can. We've covered that case. I can't remember the guy's name, the kid's name that Leonardo DiCaprio plays him.
Yeah, I've heard of him before. He's kind of a,
but yeah,
he's been in some stuff.
He was captured over, I think, in France and was held in this awful prison until America came in to extradite him. And it's interesting. So this also kind of, the Geneva Convention deals with how people are held when they are faced with the consequences of their actions. The Kandahar massacre prompted a review of military policies and procedures regarding the mental health and well-being of soldiers. I feel like this is probably, I mean, this definitely put a match under some folks to review it a little quicker and with more urgency, but I feel like this is something that's been researched and studied since, I don't know, the early 2000s, because we've been at war, like I said, that whole time.
As a direct response to this case, the U.S. military did increase access to mental health services for service members. They implemented programs to address challenges of reintegration into civilian life. Obviously, this was done at wartime. He was in another country as part of his service, but there's a lot more being done now to help people get back into their everyday lives once they are back home. And allegedly, they're trying to help individuals to reduce the stigma of being associated with seeking help and let people know that it is okay to get help, which is, my goodness, John, when we were kids, nobody thought it was okay to get help. It was suck it up and get through it. If you go to see a therapist, you just can't handle it, which is just mind-boggling to me that we ever said that to people.
Yeah, he was offered help. They saw some issues going on. This was not his first run-in with the law, and I think we could probably spend some time just talking about who he was even before the massacre, but at one time he was offered some help, and he said, no, I'm a man. I don't talk about my feelings. I'm good. And that was kind of it. He had prior charges of basically domestic violence type stuff. He had been charged for assaulting his girlfriend back in 2002. In 2003, he had met another woman, and that ended poorly. He was detained in 2008 after fleeing from a hit-and-run accident. As I said, he played football. He had some TBI issues from that time. He also was involved in some fraud activities where he had stolen some money. He was liable in a financial fraud case relating to the handling of a retirement account, and he was ordered to pay $1.2 million in civil damages. And there was a victim that is probably never going to see a penny of that. But interesting to say the least, like this was not a normal guy who experienced TBI and PTSD and then went berserk. I think this was a guy who struggled for years and years and years before he went over and experienced those awful things and then did something awful.
But what do you do with that? I mean, I do realize that there are specifications to get in the military, but are you going to say, no, this guy's too violent to be in the Army? Like, is that a thing? Like, the mental stability, yes. I could see that saying, you know what, he's not able to always give us his best through these mental health issues, but I don't know. Like, I also am not aware of, at this point in time, where we were with a lack of willing participants in the military. Back in World War II, we had to have a draft. We haven't done that since, I don't think. I don't know if we did it with Vietnam or not, but certainly not since I've been an adult. We've had enough willing soldiers, which I guess, how many people are they turning away? So, to me, it just so many questions that I had never considered before about the mental health of soldiers, their actions overseas, what we should do to prevent that, whether it's not letting them into the military versus once they get in, providing the right services. Just so much happening.
Yeah, he tried to just, I'm sorry, I'm kind of bouncing around. He tried to justify his actions before he ultimately pled guilty. In one interview, he contradicted himself in the interview, but he said that he only went to homes where there were suspected insurgents, where there were satellite phones, there were bombs and rifles that had previously been found. But later in the same interview, he said, no, he didn't find any of those things. He it seemed as if he just went on a cold, like a killing spree.
It's basically like he snapped and had to go kill a bunch of people. And to do that, man, I mean, is that a, I guess we talk about serial killers having a cool down period. He didn't have that, but to kill 17 people.
Yeah. And then of course, several of those places where the murder victims were burnt down. And in that same interview, he's like, no, I didn't do that. It must've been a lantern that knocked over like multiple times.
Sure, buddy.
Yeah.
I don't know. A messy situation for sure. An embarrassment for the American military to have to deal with that publicly. But just really hopeful that things are changing and that mental health is a higher priority in our military moving forward and militaries across the world. But when you're trying to govern different governments, everything gets super messy and hard to keep up with.
This is an interesting case, and it's one I don't know that we've ever covered a war crimes case. So this one is certainly interesting.
And of course, we reference the individual that blew up his Tesla outside of a building. And there are all kinds of conspiracy conversations happening about what happened there. But I think some of it can go back to the pieces we've discussed today about the mental health of soldiers, what they go through, what they're asked to do, and what life's like when they come back.
I'm going to point out one more interesting thing and ask you a question. So, of course, they did an investigation in this case. I mean, they knew it was him. They had surveillance. They knew when he left the last home that this had happened, and they have evidence of him walking back to base. But they still had to go in and go to all these homes to investigate. Well, their presence, the Army's presence during that investigation, sparked another conflict, and actually an Afghanistan soldier was killed in that conflict that arose. So I almost would want to retroactively like tack on that soldier's death onto him, because
it's his responsibility.
This would not have happened if you hadn't have done what you did. So
right.
I don't know. Yeah. Maybe that's not lawful in and of itself, but it is definitely a consequence of his actions.
I don't know if it's lawful enough, but you're right. It does seem like the just thing to do or to think about. But yeah, there are a lot more of these cases, I think, than we are aware of, or probably more than we want to think exist. But this is one of the more public ones that really came out and hopefully led to some change, but still more work to be done.
Jamie, appreciate you researching this one, man, and bringing it to us.
Yeah, guys, we appreciate all of you. Would love some more 5-star reviews over on Apple Podcasts. We will read those at the top of each show, And be on the lookout for us to share some information about CrimeCon with some special discounts we're going to be able to offer.
And until next crime, this has been True Crimecast.
You've listened to True Crimecast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.